everybody, this is William Del Pilar, and this is Points on the Board. And we have a hell of a show for you tonight. As those of you who regularly watch this, you know, this is where politics and sports collide. We talk about the intersectionality of it when the stories are there. If not, we talk about some regular sports. Rarely do we have an episode, though, where that does not happen. And tonight is no different. We're going to talk about March Madness. No politics in that. We're going to talk about some NFL news. There's no politics in that. Then we are going to talk about racism and sports and Cheryl Miller's honest assessment of the reality of what's happening to Caitlin Clark in the WNBA. And then we're also going to talk about Ryan Clark and his lie. It's another lie. And as a Latino, I always tell my Latino brethren and some of the black friends I grew up around, we as minorities, and they always looked at me, and one of my relatives once said, well, you're different. Fair point, point taken. But I also said, as minorities, we have to look in the mirror and realize that racism is not just from one class. That until we look in the mirror and realize hate begets hate, and hate is taught. And when you're taught to hate and become a victim, we will never move forward. And I want to talk a little bit about that based off of what Cheryl Miller says, as well as the hate Ryan Clark keeps pushing. Why? Maybe it's good for ratings. Maybe he himself is a closet racist. I don't know, but we are going to talk about that as well. It's a heavy show, so I want to get right into it. Oh, and then we'll end the show with what is my favorite out of all my podcasts, and that's the lightning round. And in this Points on the Board, I call it the final whistle, where I take a look at stories around the nation and sometimes around the world, where sports and politics collide, again, not always, and I give you my quick analysis of it. So before I move forward, though, I have to do my administrative obligation and make sure you are aware to bookmark grumblingsmedia.com. You can find this podcast, my Points on the Board, as well as our political and our other sports and our entertainment podcast there. And I'm sure most of you are watching this on one of the other platforms, Rumble, YouTube, Apple, Spotify, y Pandora, under the profile handle Grumblings Media. And with that, let's jump right into it. UNC's controversial March Madness lifeline. How Metrics Memphis and the Chairman's Shadow secured the Tar Heels spot. So, full transparency, I now live in San Diego. Grew up in North Carolina after having moved there as a child from Panama. I'm an American citizen, but that's where the folks settled down at. My father was part of the Special Forces community, so Fort Bragg was always home. And the reason I say that is, ironically, UNC did get into the March Madness tournament, and they will face San Diego State. By the time you've seen this, we'll know who has won. I have been in San Diego now since 1990. So, gosh, I've been in San Diego now longer than I was in Vietnam, North Carolina. But Vietnam will always be home and hold something special to me. But I'll be rooting for the Aztecs. So let's get down and dirty into this topic. And the NCAA selection process always stirs up drama. That's not even debatable. And this year, North Carolina's last second inclusion as the final team in the field sparked plenty of debate. So how did the Tar Heels nab that coveted spot? And why are fans and analysts buzzing about it, with a lot of them legitimately upset, myself included? So this is their 53rd NCAA tournament appearance. And despite losing to Duke in the ACC semifinal this past week due to a late lane violation call, I guess, the Tar Heels secured the final spot in one of the last four in per ESPN. Oh, they were all reporting it. Just I saw it on ESPN. So as a number 11 seed in the Final Four, USC will face San Diego State. And by the time you're watching this, that game will have taken place. And the winner will advance to meet Ole Miss in the South region. And we'll take it from there next week and give you the lowdown if they deserved it or not. And we'll get to the end of the segment. I'll tell you why I say that. But so the selection committee's decision rested on the AAC championship game on March 15th. And that's where Memphis, that who was a lock for an at-large bid, faced UAB, University of Alabama, Birmingham. And they needed this to get the automatic bid. UNC got in because Memphis won. So that freed up a spot. And that was confirmed by the vice chair, Keith Gill. So Memphis beat UAB 84-72, clinching the AAC's automatic bid. See, had UAB won, they would have gotten the automatic bid. Memphis would have already been a lock to get in. UNC would have been on the outside looking in. So because they lost, which was expected, North Carolina got the last spot. And that means Boise State, who was a late surging Mountain West contender, they were out, despite going 5-1 in its last six games. So why is UNC under the hot seat? You think UNC, the Tar Heels, they're just not very good. And they haven't been for a while. They've been so damn inconsistent. So UNC had a 1-12 record in quadrant one games, and their only win was over UCLA in December, so a while ago. And they had a quad three loss to Stanford at home. So look at it this way. Quad ones are the monumental battles when Duke and UNC were top dogs in the nation. That would be a quad one game. Against Kentucky, when they were top dog, would be a quad one game. Against Connecticut of the last couple years would be a quad one game. So Georgetown with Ewing would be a quad one game. Stanford would be the equivalent of a team near the bottom of the conference. So why do I say that? Well, quadrant one games are the toughest matchups against the top teams. There's a computer process they use that views a team as a top 30 at home, a top 50 if it's neutral, top 75 on the road, and anywhere in between, I guess. But in essence, it's ranking the difficulty of your schedule. And they were 1-12 against the best teams teams in quadrant one, which means UNC's not a powerhouse, at least this season. They are a hanger-on. And it's their name recognition that got them in. So they, teams that were snubbed, like West Virginia with 6 quad one wins, Indiana with 4, and Boise State with 3, all had more victories than UNC's single win in 13 tries against top teams. And going back to Boise State, they were also 5-1 their last 6 games. I'm not alone in my assessment that UNC did not deserve to get in. ESPN's Dick Vitale, he called UNC's selection a mistake, and he praised Boise's 5-1 finish. Now, UNC had a solid Ken Pom, which is 33rd, and a solid net rankings of 36. Then there's Bubba Cunningham. Bubba. He's the selection committee chair. He is also UNC's athletic director since 2011. He earns $815,000 annually, and there's a $50,000 bonus if the Tar Heels hit the Sweet 16. Obviously, social media was outraged over this potential bias, despite his recusal in terms of discussing who would get that. Now, let me tell you something about that. Well, first of all, as a chair since 2024, he's fairly new to it. On the 12-member committee of athletic directors and commissioners, Cunningham helped shape the selection process itself. But when it came to UNC, they say he deferred to Keith Gill. Again, social media dubbed it blatantly corrupt over his dual roles. And I agree. I totally agree. And here's why. So I'm going to give you the technicalities where people are going to use to justify it. But at the end of the day, it doesn't matter that he stepped out of the room. He has relationships with every individual who is making that decision. And when you have friends like that, they are going to lean your way. Because if they don't, there will be ramifications down the road. Or it's a simple scratch my back this time, I'll scratch your back during the year when your team's on the bubble. So it is corrupt. It is corrupt. UNC should not have been let in, even for perception, because at the end of the day, they didn't deserve to get in. Now, here's where some people are going to say, well, they did deserve it. William, you're wrong. So the committee leaned on tools like Torvik and WAB, and they predict team strength, just like Ken Pom does. And you combine that with the NET rankings, and they decided to pick UNC over West Virginia. Now, West Virginia, I can see that to a degree because their offense had tanked to 68.2 points per game. It was 343rd nationally. Why? Because they lost one of their star players, Tucker DeVry's February injury, which knocked them out for the rest of the season. Now, that said, Dick Vitale said they were robbed. Boise State, that is. And so there was only one big surprise in the conference tournaments. So the race for the last spot got tight, meaning there weren't upsets where some teams would, like UAB. Had they won, everything would have been lock, stock, and barrel. But that one slot is what opened it up. So they obviously, with only one slot, the competition for it was tough. And Cunningham lied and said it was a hard choice. No, Cunningham, give me something. I don't have my back scratcher. You know, scratch my back. That's what this was. You know, so West Virginia had a 19-13 record, and they had some weak offensive stats, 103rd in efficiency. And they said that wasn't enough to top UNC. You know what is enough? Going 1-12 in quad one games. That's enough. Everything else is just numbers. It's what happens on the court. And what happened on the court? 1-12, people. The Tar Heels stunk. They were losers. They were as useful as a, I can't say that. I'm trying to keep it clean. But they were non-deserving to get in. 1-12. That's the only one that really matters. Because you can throw any stat you want. How did they actually perform? And they were outperformed by these other teams. Because the numbers are debatable. That quad one, one loss record is not. So, the fan backlash again erupted on social media with Vitale tweeting Boise State's exclusion as an injustice. I think he should have gone all the way. A social injustice! And Boise's coach and fans pointed to their 5 wins in 6 games. You know, and it's obvious Cunningham's way tipped the scales. Despite the standards, it was fair. It was not fair. He has relations with all of those making the pick. They like him. He's their bud.
Scratch my back, I scratch your back.
Now, what will change this? Oh, they make a deep run. Unlikely. That might, though, that will quiet the critics. But let's say they lose this Thursday or Tuesday, tomorrow. Woo, it's going to blow up. I don't know who's going to win that game, to be quite honest. But an early exit, it's going to amplify all the dogging of this tournament committee, because teams like Boise State with its late surge or West Virginia, despite injury woes, deserve the nod. I'll make a comment here about the injury woes. You know, they weren't playing their best, but they had a better quad one record than UNC. And at the end of the day, basketball is a team sport. What the committee did was they put one player's injury and they said, y'all suck. So they took all the rest of the team and said, y'all suck, get out of here. That's disgraceful, disrespectful, and a dishonorable thing to do to those kids who work hard themselves to be part of the team. You think the Rice could have won all those games without that team? No. So I understand the importance, but you got to look beyond those type of biases. You know, but the only one, the only stat, again, that mattered, 1-12 against quad one. Loser! So, North Carolina, they squeaked into the tournament thanks to a Memphis win and some favorable metrics. The debate over their spot and Cunningham's biased and putting his finger on the scale won't die down anytime soon. So let's talk some NFL free agency news and ramifications. First up, Aaron Rodgers' contract standoff. Key issues and some insights. Okay. Aaron Rodgers, obviously, he's a four-time NFL MVP. He remains a free agent, and he's got some steep contract demands, and it's creating a standout with teams that are interested in him, like the Steelers, the Giants. And what is that high price tag? Well, he's reportedly seeking a contract mirroring Sam Darnold's 3-year, $100.5 million deal with the Seahawks, a demand that has left the Steelers and Giants hesitant. And I can't blame them, especially with Russell Wilson being available. So my take is, look, this reeks of greed. Rodgers' baggage and last season's disconnect between his stats and yet how poorly the team played and their lack of wins. What I'm trying to say is stats look decent on paper, but the team sucked. There was no chemistry. He was a terrible team leader, et cetera, et cetera. Now, he's trying to sell himself to the Vikings. I mentioned the Steelers and Giants, but the other team in the mix is the Vikings. That all depends on how far along J.J. McCarthy is, but there's no doubt Rodgers does have it in him for 1 year under Kevin O'Connell's offense. He could take that team to the Super Bowl, but his greed may keep that from happening. I'd love to see him in Minnesota for 1 year. My take, give him a 1 year incentive heavy deal and say, look, bro, we all know this is the end of the deal, year, end of the road for you. Now, you may do a multi-year contract to spread out the salary cap, however they can work their magic, but just make it literally a 1 year deal. You know, and the Giants, I mean, why wouldn't he suck it up? I mean, the guy's going down in history as one who never hit his ceiling in terms of Super Bowls. All those stats are nothing. The guy was a loser when it came to the playoffs. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. A loser when it came to the playoffs. And how some of those losses came about just leaves you scratching your head. So if he could wind up with the Vikings taking the Super Bowl, he could ride off into the sunset. The Giants, that's just a money grab. They're not going anywhere. And the Steelers, vanilla offense under Mike Tomlin, that feels like a mismatch despite their interests. Speaking of Giants, former Giants quarterback Daniel Jones joins the Colts to challenge Richardson, Anthony Richardson, for starting QB. This was a great signing by both sides. Look, Daniel Jones signed a one-year $14 million deal with the Colts, and he's a seasoned quarterback with a proven 2022 playoff run, including a standout game against the State of Colts. And he will challenge Anthony Richardson. And the team did sit there and say they were going to bring somebody in to challenge him. So look, Indy has a superior offensive line when you compare it to what the Giants had. It's a stark upgrade from his Giants days. So Jones could thrive in an open competition, and that's contrasting sharply with Richardson's dual threat promise. Jones does bring some of that himself, but the problem with Richardson is he can run people over, but he's brittle as peanut brittle. He also has a league worst 47.7% completion rate, i.e., or is it AKA? In other words, he can't hit the side of a barn if the barn was 5 feet in front of him. And again, he's like peanut brittle, 17 games missed in two seasons. The downside is if he doesn't get the starting job, his psyche could be destroyed for good. The Colts should have thought about that when they drafted him. I predicted all this and how it would play out. My take is easy. Daniel Jones joined the Colts for a straightforward reason. A much improved offensive line compared to the Giants' dismal protection. It's going to set up a battle which he believes he can win. I'm sure he did not sign without them telling him it's going to be an open competition. I mean, if it wasn't, why bother? Just go back to Minnesota. Yeah. So my question is, does Daniel Jones still have a little bit of the happy feet he showed at times because he kept getting beat up? He didn't show it too much, but it rattled him. You saw his throws, his reads. It was all affected because he knew he had an offensive line that could not protect him. And after he left, you saw how bad it really was with their QB play. So this is a sensible move for both teams, for both the player and the team. The only one who's losing now here is Anthony Richardson. So we shall see how this plays out. This is going to be a fun one to watch. From a tribalism standpoint, which happens in a lot of football now, it's going to happen, but just throw that under the bus. I want to see these two guys go at it and see who wins out, because I do think Daniel Jones will win just because he's the better quarterback at this point in time. And I think Richardson should sit on the bench for a year. Bengals lock in Jamar Chase and T. Higgins with massive extensions, raising questions on team building priorities. All right, so the Bengals have secured their star wide receivers, Jamar Chase and T. Higgins, with lucrative four-year contracts. Chase is the highest paid non-quarterback in NFL history. How many weeks that lasts, we don't know. But there's the debate over resource allocation on a roster needing defensive and offensive line help. Show me the money. Chase has a four-year, $161 million deal, $112 million guaranteed, and Higgins has a four-year, $115 million contract, 2 years guaranteed. Obviously, they're going to have an elite passing game, but the teams, I don't know, they delayed in signing these two guys, which increased their cost $5 to $10 million. But my take is this. When a team invests heavily in three players, the two receivers and Joe Burrow, and yet they're struggling with a porous offensive line and a defense, and they're turning around and talking about trading sack leader Trey Hendrickson, I don't know. To me, it exposes a mismanagement of priorities. Quarterbacks elevate wideouts more than wideouts define their success. So what I'm suggesting is that funds might better bolster complementary positions like the lines. The Ravens bolster offense with DeAndre Hopkins signing for a 2025 push for the Super Bowl. Look, the Baltimore Ravens signed veteran wide receiver DeAndre Hopkins, one-year, $6 million deal, addressing their need for depth behind Zay Flowers and Rashad Bateman. Look, DeAndre Hopkins is going to see time. This is a strategic signing for depth and experience and actually play on the field. Hopkins is a five-time All-Pro with reliable hands and strong route running skills. He brings 13 years of experience, 984 receptions, nearly 13,000 yards, and 83 TDs. He is going to make that team better. The Ravens' offense ranked number one in 2024, despite players in their declining years, specifically Derrick Henry. You know, Hopkins and Henry, two studs, two locker room leaders. I don't know how much of a leader Lamar Jackson is, but they had two now. And people will sit there and say, William, he's not quite the leader. Well, yeah, his final year in Arizona was a terrible year. He was a terrible human being and how he treated his teammates and how he treated that team. And then he chased the money when he went to Tennessee. But then he wanted a ring, got traded to KC, got beat. He's hunting for a ring now. That $6 million contract shows that. He wants a ring now, so I'm not saying he's changed, but he's never been a real issue on the field for the Titans and for the Chiefs. So he joins his fifth team and third in 2 years, Titans, Chiefs, and now the Ravens. So this is, again, a shift from chasing the lucrative contracts he had with the Titans to getting what he can now. In defense of his critics, sure, he's on his final legs, but I think he could have gotten a better deal elsewhere. But he's going after that Super Bowl ring. His fit with Lamar Jackson, and look, it's a loaded Ravens roster. Derrick Henry and Mark Andrews, that positions him as a complimentary piece rather than the primary star. And he's the type of guy who defenses probably won't game plan for, but he's going to burn them. May not be every week, but they're going to pick and choose. And I think this is a great signing by the Ravens and a great signing for Lamar Jackson on third downs. $6 million, great deal. For a player with solid hands and reliable route running ability, he's hungry for the championship. He's chased money in the past. He's not focused on a ring. He was unhappy in Tennessee, but he stayed professional. Let's watch this one play out. Bills bolster pass rush with Joey Bosa signing. So look, the Buffalo Bills they signed an edge rusher in Joey Bosa to a 1 year, $12.6 million deal to replace Von Miller. And they're strengthening their pass rush. So AJ Epenesa underperformed as a starter and Miller had limited snaps. So they needed to upgrade this position. They needed to fill it out a bit. Because obviously the defense was impacted because of that. So Bosa is a former Pro Bowler, has a history of double-digit sack seasons. He's a significant upgrade only if he can stay healthy. He's going to pair with Greg Rousseau to create a formidable duo. Staying healthy is the key. This is a high-reward, high-risk play. You know, he's a proven talent, 72 career sacks, 2024 Pro Bowl nod, but he has injury history. It's a major caveat. You know, he's missed 23 games over the past three seasons and playing only 50% of snaps in 2024. So the Bills' manageable contract reflects his market value post-Chargers release. But his ability to stay on the field will determine whether this prove-it deal elevates their Super Bowl chances. We shall see. If he stays healthy, hell of a signing. Jordan Schultz escalates feud with NFL Network over Bengals extensions credit. So Jordan Schultz is Fox Sports Insider. So he's clashed with Ian Rappaport, I guess, or Tom Pelissero, the NFL guys, I guess. But it's an issue with the NFL Network over credit over breaking the Bengals extension news. And that they have a simmering feud going, a rivalry. And they call it professional pride and media dynamics. No. And I'll tell you why shortly. So, again, he's a Fox Sports NFL insider, which makes me wonder, what happened to Jay Glazer? He used to be a hell of an insider, but he doesn't do much insider reporting anymore. But he publicly challenged their failure to credit him for breaking the news of the Bengals contract extension, and he rightfully should have done that. You know, I have seen Pelissero or who's the guy at ESPN? I'm drawing a blank now. Schefter. And they whine and cry about, hey, how hard their job is or this or that. They're liars when it comes to that aspect because they're ESPN and NFL Network. And when they make a call, they get a response. Fox, this is a guy who's had to build his name, build his cred. Fox had Glazer who could get anybody to pick up the phone. So he's worked hard at his craft. You know, he broke the Jamar Chase and T. Higgins, and he reported it 20 minutes before NFL Network's Tom Pelissero. I remember those days, you know, when I had the player news. If you played fantasy sports from the 90s up until I sold the company in 2006 and then I left in 2010, we owned the market on player news. When I sold it, God, boy, they ran. USA Today has destroyed the company I built. You don't even know it's there. God, some just bad decision after bad decision. And they wonder why they're going to be out of business here in the next 5-10 years. That's a whole story unto itself. But anyway, so I understand how it is for player news and breaking it because we broke a lot. In fact, we were the NFL Network's first fantasy analyst, and Rich Eisen on Total Access threw it to me and my partner because we had some breaking news. The producers pulled us aside and said, only Rich Eisen breaks news. But you see where I'm going with the NFL Network. They will do anything to make sure they claim the credit. So, obviously, this is a broader tension between Schultz and the NFL Network insiders. It's exasperated by a prior confrontation with Rapoport at the NFL Scouting Combine. We saw that it made news. Schultz asserts the league's official X account routinely favors crediting its own media personnel. And that's fine as long as they break it. But they don't break it. But they credit them as if they did. What they need is their breaking news to the NFL Network. My take is having navigated the NFL insider world myself, relying on 32-bit reporters rather than claiming so credit. I know how this all works. I see Schultz's frustration as justified. His scoop was overshadowed by what I perceive as an arrogant tendency among NFL.com and ESPN insiders. This is with the NFL Network, but ESPN does it too. And they poach or downplay others' works, though they too have advanced beyond mere aggregation. What I'm saying is, we all aggregate it, they're breaking it, but they don't want to admit it when they don't break it, but yet they'll still claim they have. ESPN and NFL Network have access, and Schultz is self-made, so I will always side with a self-made guy. Eagles embrace White House honor, ending political standoff. Okay, the Philadelphia Eagles accepted President Donald Trump's invitation. I talked about this before, to celebrate their victory. So unlike their 2018 refusal, which was sheer stupidity amid tensions over anthem protests where they were used like dogs, you know, or seals, you know, hey, just do what the Democrats tell you to do. Even though these players are in the 1%, they're great role models, they bought into the victim mentality in 2018. It was disgusting, disgraceful, and those players who will not win another Super Bowl will regret because they will not have an opportunity to go visit the White House again. So this shifts an obvious change. The real Donald Trump is finally overcoming the media lies. You know, the Warriors rejected. Oh, my God. Steve Kerr is as big a cuck as you will ever find. He is someone who is on. I can't talk like that anymore. I promised the company I would chill out. But he's just a terrible human being. He wishes ill, wishes death, wishes nothing but hate towards those he disagrees with. Why he lives in his white ivory tower? You don't ever hear Steve Kerr talking about how China uses slave labor with the Muslims they have in camps making NFL gear. Him and Mark Cuban are the worst. Popovich, well, he's barely hanging on right now. He's the same way. So I in my notes, I'm like, the Warriors rejection 2017, 2018, they're terrible human beings. I mean, my God, they give Draymond Green, they allow him to beat up people, lie about people, say everything he wants. They don't care. It just tells you what kind of organization they are. And I don't care what you tell them about Steph Curry. He condones it by accepting it and by not being a leader. It's that simple. Well, then again, he's not a leader, so maybe that's why. So my take, though, with the Eagles, this is a smart move, if only for the fact that the opportunity to be honored at the White House, regardless of who's president, is a once-in-a-lifetime event, and that's worth cherishing. Playing petty politics just makes you a pawn in the Democrat plantation game. And we fought a civil war to get all minorities off the Democrat plantation, specifically blacks in the Civil War. But since the 60s, the Democrats have recreated the plantation, only now it's in a, what's the word? I don't know what the word I'm looking for, but it's not a physical form, but it's out there metaphorically. Because if you leave the plantation, they will try their best to destroy you. Look at every black man who's left the plantation. Look at Donald Trump when he left the Democrat Party to become a Republican. It's refreshing to see this tradition rise above the noise. So let's get down to it. A very heavy topic. Facing the Mirror, Cheryl Miller's Truth, Ryan Clark's Lies, and the Path to Healing Racial Tensions in Sports. So Cheryl Miller is a Women's Basketball Hall of Famer. And she courageously spoke on an uncomfortable truth on the DraftKings Network about Caitlin Clark, admitting, quote, "I know what it's like to be hated because of my color," unquote. She says some stuff in between, but dot, 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 because of my color. Her statement acknowledged that Clark, a straight white woman in a league, the WNBA, predominantly composed of black lesbians, faces racial animosity. And she drew a parallel to Miller's own experience as a black woman. This honesty that Clark is hated due to her race challenges the dominant narrative of white privilege, often weaponized against Clark. This is an ideological tribalism. She spoke the truth. This is one reason I got into politics. We're not going to move forward as a country until, I always tell my Latino brethren, but for black Americans too, well, you got to look in the mirror, people, because racism is hate, and hate is top. There's a video a few years ago of a 2-year-old black child hating and trying to hit on the cop. But she didn't grow up with a gene that says, "I hate cops." No, she was taught that hate. So again, that honesty, it's challenging the narrative. That narrative being white privilege. And obviously against Clark. And it reveals a raw racial dynamic where some black players and commentators target her success. And kudos to Outkick. They really had a nice article about this. So you got to sit there and praise Miller for speaking ugly truths. Because you know why? She's going to face potential. It's not going to be potential. She will face backlash. She will be seen as having left the plantation. And they will do everything they can to punish her for that. She's going to face race bullies and mean girls in the WNBA for siding with – she's not siding with Clark, actually. She's stating an ugly truth. So the truth-telling exposes the territorial resentment some black athletes and media figures harbor toward white stars like Clark. I can't remember who it was. I want to say Aja Wilson, I think, was telling – she just got traded. I can't remember. She was in the married to the tight end for the Giants, or tight end for the Raiders, rather, or one of the NFL tight ends, and got divorced. But she was telling her pretty much, "You have white privilege," you know. And so they play this game. You know, in the NBA, Nikola Jokic gets this hit on him all the time. Doncic, Luka Doncic too. You know, Kendrick Perkins and Gilbert Arenas, they play the race card. These people are deep down racist. And that's why they play this card. The problem is when it was white racism, we would rightfully stamp that out. We didn't want none of that. And we need to start doing that here, but we don't. And until that happens, we're never going to come together. White, black, Latino, Asian should be stamping out racism anywhere. And until that happens, we are going to be a tribalistic. And why does that happen? Because Racism is a multi-billion dollar industry. And when Democrats are constantly playing the race card, Latino activist leaders, Black activist leaders, Asian activist leaders, when they play this card of victimhood and victim mentality, this is what happens. We need to come together. When I go home, and I've lost a lot of Black friends, and I don't care. You weren't really my friend. The worst ones are the ones on Facebook. Facebook. Well, you know, I thought we were friends, man. I'm like, dude, I haven't spoken to you in 20 some odd years. We said hello because you came on Facebook and I was on Facebook. You know, we're not friends. So let's keep moving forward with this. Ryan Clark, he's one of these individuals perpetuating a lie about racial bias, this time in the NFL. And I tie these two stories together because it shows where one admits what's happening, the other one continues the lie. So, and this is in stark contrast. ESPN analyst Ryan Clark perpetuates what critics call a divisive lie by claiming Shedeur Sanders' falling draft stock is due to racial bias. Say that on First Take. And most of them, I'm sure, were like, So, quote, it is about the fact that the color of his skin, sometimes that the position can be questioned, unquote. It's a flat out lie. So his narrative suggests systemic racism and unfairly targeting Sanders, a Black quarterback. Evidence doesn't show that. It doesn't stand up to the evidence. And obviously there was good public pushback. There were a couple of guys on X. I saw a guy named GunnerDog99 and Pro_Trading. I don't know them from a hole in the wall, but their comments on this point were spot on, and they refuted the claim, and they proved it's rooted in performance and personality, not race. And their comments highlighted recent draft history where Black quarterbacks like Caleb Williams, 2024, number one pick overall, Jaden Daniels, 2024, number two pick, and Bryce Young, 2023, number one pick, got drafted high. And the fact that 47% of NFL starting quarterbacks are Black, and that undermines any systemic bias narrative. Clark just wants to play the race card because it's all he has. And I believe he's a racist. Now, there are scouting reports that say Sanders is brash and arrogant. Yeah, I think his dad's gotten into his head way too much. He needs to be a little bit more humble because I see that too. That suggests his draft drop, reflects those traits and on-field performance, not racial prejudice. Even the Daily Mail, which is a leftist rag, accused Clark of pushing a false attention-seeking race car narrative that does nothing but deepen racial division rather than addressing the reality. And let's look at historical quarterback draft drops. That further disproves his claim. Remember somebody named Aaron Rodgers? And I'm going off the top of my head in terms of big names. I'm sure there's others. He fell in 24th overall pick. Hall of Fame career, Super Bowl champion, four-time MVP. One of the NFL all-time greats. And sometimes you don't get it. Ryan Leaf, pick number two overall, flop. Jamarcus Russell, pick number one overall, flop. Dan Marino slid to the 27th pick in the 83 NFL draft amid rumors later debunked of drug use and team preferences. He went on to become a Hall of Famer, took his team to the Super Bowl. Tons of records. So these examples demonstrate that draft position often influenced by subjective evaluations or team needs rather than race. And it doesn't predict ultimate success. Sanders' situation aligns more with these cases of team fit, arrogant. He can prove them all wrong, as Aaron Rodgers and Dan Marino and others have. Drew Brees taking the second round. Kirk Cousins, I want to say the third round. So why won't racial relations move forward? Well, we minorities have to look in the mirror. And when I say we minorities, yes, I am talking about my darker skinned brethren, my aunt, uncles, cousins. You know, there's like a couple of us with this skin tone. So I do understand that. But it's no different. Blacks and Latinos who play this game. we have to look in the mirror and understand it's hate and it's talk and it's a victim mentality. It's an excuse. It's just an excuse you're willing to throw out because you won't admit to your own failures and improve. Is there racism out there? Yeah. I've also seen racism towards whites. I've seen racism towards every culture. That happens when you travel to 30 some odd countries and you join the military. So these are contrasting approaches between Miller and Clark, and they highlight a critical barrier to improving race relations. Minorities, again, must confront their role in perpetuating racial tensions, WNBA ladies, as Cheryl Miller stated. And these racial tensions that are perpetuating is because they're spewing lies and divisive narratives. So Miller's truth-telling that acknowledges racial animosity against Clark, you know, that does require courage and on her part, and an ability to self-reflect as well. She's probably thinking, how many times did I throw it out there and I shouldn't have? We all do that in terms of things we know we shouldn't do and we do anyway because we know we can get away with it. And challenging the victimhood narrative some black athletes and Latinos and Asians have. And commentators too. And they cling to it even when evidence like Clark's contributions to the WNBA in season one or Sanders' performance issues contradicts it. Clark's insistence on racial bias, despite data showing black quarterbacks thriving, exemplifies how false claims of systemic racism deepen divides, alienate others, and obscure real issues like performance or attitude. So the Manhattan Institute did a study. And it had a critique of critical race theory narratives, suggesting that progressives' investment in victimhood stories damages black confidence and agency. In other words, they make it worse. Why? Well, there's money on the line for them. Most African Americans prefer resilience over dependency, but are undermined by racial narratives. So this is a survey done. They're saying, yeah, I want to be judged based off the... somebody famous said it, off my character, not my skin color. Study bore that out. So until minorities, some athletes and media figures stop pushing untruths, and this isn't everybody, I'm not making a blanket statement, but y'all know who I'm talking to, Stephen A. Smith, Jemele Hill. Until you stop pushing untruths, whether it's white privilege in the WNBA or racial bias in the NFL, and instead engage in honest self-examination, let's have that talk on race, which to a leftist means you will listen to what I tell you is racist, and if you disagree, you are a racist. That's their talk. But no, let's have a real talk. And until that happens, racial tensions will persist, and that's going to create mistrust and division rather than mutual understanding. I think the self-reflection could follow Miller's example, building a future where racial insults lose their power because of confidence. I mean, I don't care what you say, I'm confident in myself, not fear. That would align with the Manhattan Institute's findings that most black Americans favor resilience over a cycle of grievance and resentment. Ryan Clark, you need to grow the bleep up. And thank you, Cheryl Miller, for saying what you did. That did take a lot of courage. Let's move on to the final whistle. I need to get one of those things. Boop, blow my whistle. Beep. Rich Rodriguez's TikTok ban and insider dynamics in sports media. So West Virginia University's new head coach, Rich Rodriguez, who was formerly an old coach, has implemented a strict ban on players dancing or creating TikTok videos during team activities, aiming to preserve the program's hard edge and refocus the team on football fundamentals after a 6-6 season. So he's returning to WVU after 17 years, has a no-nonsense approach, he's prohibiting social media distractions, and that's a move that contrasts with the modern athletes expressing themselves, but it aligns with his goal to restore the Mountaineers' competitive identity. My take is simple. He's laser focused on building a disciplined West Virginia team. He's prioritizing football over social media distractions like TikTok. And if he can revive the Mountaineers into the powerhouse of his first stint, this approach will stick. And winning breeds success. NIL dollars will follow performance on the field. not on social media. And other coaches may take note if he pulls it off. Final whistle number two, John Feinstein's legacy. I'm not a John Feinstein fan, but he was a prolific sports journalist and author. He left a mark pre-internet through his books, his storytelling. They say he was uncompromising to tough questions. I don't believe that. He wrote a book. He wrote over 40 books, but pretty much was a one-trick pony with one book, and that was his coverage of the Indiana Hoosiers and their undefeated season in 85. His 44th book, Raise a Fist, Take a Knee, that was not met with great sales, but it was met with great critical applaud because he took the wrong side. He took the side of hate, racism, bigotry, and being anti-American. And as somebody who knows immigrants who comes from a different country, his parents do, the importance of being patriotic, of keeping a strong, unified America, is important to longevity of our civilization. And when you have crap like what John Feinstein supported, that's destroying the country from within. How do I know this? I'm a student of history. This is how literally most civilizations have gone to the wayside. Amy Chua, look her up. She talks about it in a couple of her books. That said, he kept writing and had massive health struggles, two heart attacks, a stroke, open heart surgery, and a cancer diagnosis. In his defense, he was in an era where a cheeseburger was a great meal. Yeah. So he wrote till his death. He was known for his outspoken nature and liberal leanings later in life. And that sometimes led to comments critical of conservative ideologies. Why I wasn't a fan. He couldn't leave that. He had to bring that front and center. He was wrong. In fact, I'm sure right now he's realizing how wrong he was. We learn all the answers once we die. He's learning now. And he once highlighted the predominantly Republican leanings of professional golfers, saying, there's not enough Democrats. Who cares? As for his relevance, his career peaked during the pre-internet era. That's why most of you will not know him. I'm not honoring him as much as recognizing he was somebody big before the internet. And the book I'm talking about is A Season on the Brink. Now, I'm sorry, I said 85. That's in 1986 that he wrote regarding the Hoosiers. He kept writing into the digital age, and he failed because he was a long-form storyteller. And as we know, the internet's not built for that. But, you know, I don't think he was a vile person. I don't think he was an evil person. I don't think he was a bad person. He was just an idiot when it came to his beliefs. And I do wish him the best as he begins his newest journey, his spiritual journey. Rest in peace, John Feinstein. I was not a fan, but I respected you. You did great work. You were a success. When I say you did great work, you did yourself justice by working hard. Much peace and love as you begin your journey. And I hope I didn't come out too bad. I didn't mean to, but I'm not going to shy away from the truth of a man who is critical and derogatory towards others at times. Tiger take number one. Tiger Woods faces long road back after Achilles surgery. So Tiger Woods announced an announcement of a ruptured Achilles tendon and now his subsequent surgery. It's just another chapter of his story, yet injury play career and the cast uncertainty over his future in professional golf. This is his 13th documented procedure since 2002. He's optimistic. He says 9 to 12 months. At his age, you're probably looking at 12 months, if not longer. So it's another setback. And age and recurring setbacks eventually wore down one of my favorite receivers, Nate Burleson, who always came back from injury. But eventually, time and age caught up to him. Age and injuries caught up to him. Woods is in a similar situation. I don't know if he'll be able to come back from this, and we'll wait and see. Tiger take number two, Tiger Woods and Vanessa Trump. A surprising romance emerges. So, the ex-wife of Donald Trump Jr. have reportedly been secretly dating since Thanksgiving. And their relationship is coming to light after they were spotted together at a golf tournament. So the bromance has approval of Donald Trump Jr., who responded with a simple cool. And President Donald Trump, a longtime friends of Woods, adding an unexpected layer of family support. My take is just too funny. I mean, I would never have seen this in a million years. But now that Woods is sidelined for the next year, he'll have plenty of time to spend with Vanessa. Much success to the both of them. CBS announcers misstep sparse controversy over Juju Watkins. This one was funny. So, during a CBS Sports broadcast of the USC-UCLA women's basketball game last week, announcer Lisa Bington's attempt to praise USC star Juju Watkins supposedly backfired. She said, talking about Watkins, saying she, quote, lit the world of Los Angeles on fire, unquote. This is March. The fires happened in January, you know, and it drew the ire of many because it was insensitive, considering the devastating L.A. wildfires. This is people on social media. They're holier than Jesus Christ. They're more pure than Jesus Christ could ever hope to be. I thought it was funny because of the irony. It's been a couple of months. There's never a too soon moment. She didn't do it on purpose. It wasn't meant as a joke or bad take because of what happened in L.A. It was just a way to describe Watkins. And it's a common line that's used in many various contexts. And while the timing wasn't ideal, Los Angelinos have bigger concerns than an announcer hurting feelings. The only people, there were no feelings hurt. It was just faux outrage. Track star incident sparks controversy over intent and accountability. I am obviously talking about the Virginia Indoor Track Championships and a viral clip that captured Lila Everett hitting, bam, Colleen Tucker with a baton. And a lip reader actually stepped in to say what she said. So Everett claims the hit was accidental. She's citing a loss of balance, but there was a lack of an apology. She never went to console the girl and say, oh, my God, it was an accident. None of that happened. That alone tells me, in my opinion, she did it on purpose. And now she's whining. Oh, I got that threat. Oh, racial tax. I mean, it was all black on black. Black schools. That makes no sense. And Tucker suffered a concussion and possible skull fracture. So my take is simple. The runner said, the livery said, get off, and then, oh, hell no. This is what she said. Get off. Oh, hell no. Bam. That's how that went down. I grew up in the South. I had a lot of friends of color. So get off. Oh, hell no. Bam. Going down, Kayleen Tucker. Oh, what gets me is how indifferent she was afterward. And now she's playing the victim, ranging from the believe me to I'm being attacked by racists. This is a calculated deflection, and I'm convinced she meant to hit her, and she just owned it instead of playing the sympathy card. I could be wrong, but here's the kicker. We'll never know. NBA investigation into the Thunder and 76ers. So the NBA has launched an investigation to the Oklahoma City Thunder and Philadelphia 76ers over potential violations of the league's player participation policy. So it focuses on the March 7th game against the Portland Trail Blazers, where the Thunder, leading the Western Conference, rested six players, including Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and Jalen Williams. And it's raising concerns despite their non-tanking status and the game not being nationally televised. There's rules on this. 76ers in a different vote. They're facing scrutiny for the absence of key players like Paul George, Tyrese Maxey. Their season is a complete and utter disappointment. No playoff hopes. They have a top six protected draft pick incentive. Some are saying, hey, this team's tanking it. My take, this was inevitable. Once you got the rule, what's the rule called again? The league's player participation policy. Once that rule was implemented, you were going to have this. I mean, people pay a lot of money to go to a game. These games aren't cheap. And when their star players are sitting more than they're playing, fans get mad and irate, season sales get canceled, team sales go down, et cetera, et cetera. So they implemented this rule. Now, some teams do need the rest players, so that's a tough call. But abuse is rampant in today's game of lies, greed, and blatant cheating. So the NBA must act as ratings drop and fans deserve to see stars. like a $100 million player who better have a solid reason to sit and not just coast. This is a league where attendance by fans costs them dearly and high price, no different than football. So I agree an investigation should be looking into it, but don't be assuming. There could be legit reasons. The Rays abandoned $1.3 billion stadium deal. It's sparking uncertainty and outrage in St. Petersburg. The Tampa Bay Rays sudden withdrawal from a long-planned $1.3 billion stadium project actually has left the team's future in the region uncertain, and it has ignited tensions, not only with local officials and fans, but also team owners. They backed out of the deal, citing delays from Hurricane Milton's damage to Tropicana Field and the subsequent county vote postponement, which they claim could increase construction costs. Construction costs are going to increase depending on how the economy is doing. So that's a flat-out excuse. Insurance hikes because of the hurricane and other issues. Excuse. And there's also a fractured relationship and ownership criticism, including Commissioner Rob Manfred has expressed frustration with the owners, with the Rays owners, Stu Stenberg. And some are calling for him to sell the team. Why? Bad faith and a deteriorating partnership. And the city plans to move forward with redeveloping the stadium site regardless. I would not be shocked if there's a potential lawsuit in the wings. My take is this is a mess. Sternberg seems checked out, and the league and fans are fed up. He's free to run his team, but screwing over a city like this could spark legal trouble and fan backlash, which means less ticket sales if they're locked in through a court decision. And while I hate seeing tax dollars fund stadiums over real community needs, this last-minute shafting feels dirty. Selling might be his best move, though I'm not holding my breath. Danica Patrick's scathing critique of the Tate brothers. Look, I'm happy to see these critiques of the Tate brothers coming out. Danica Patrick recently unleashed a fiery condemnation. Fire and brimstone, baby! Of the Tate brothers, spotlighting the controversial views on women and masculinity in a way that hasn't really sparked heated debate, but has made the news. The Tate brothers are losing their steam. They're losing their fans. Patrick, obviously, if this isn't sports segment, because she's a former race car driver turned outspoken commentator. She's a big Trump fan, and she didn't hold back calling out the brothers for their documented behavior and statements that objectify women, labeling them as epitome of toxic masculinity that fuels culture divides. And you know what? She's absolutely right. The Tate brothers have some kind of appeal to young men, and it's from a backlash against the left's attack on masculinity from Obama's era. I mean, Obama was the least masculine president we have had in my lifetime. Yeah. But this defiance doesn't erase the damage of their views, making them a liability conservatives should not be supporting. So look, the Tate brothers' brutal objectifying stance on women, backed by videos of with their own words and action, makes them indefensible as role models. And when I shake my head at conservatives like Tucker Carlson and Patrick Beck David, who I enjoy watching, for defending them. Their defiance of the left's anti-masculinity crusade has fooled some into ignoring their flaws, the Tate's flaws. And what they've done is they've handed Democrats a perfect poster child for toxic masculinity. What I'm trying to say here, when Tucker and Patrick Bet-David defend these cretins, all they're doing is handing Democrats ammunition. Because when you talk toxic masculinity, you're talking to Tate brothers. Phil Mickelson praises Elon Musk's role in U.S. fiscal responsibility. So professional golfer Phil Mickelson recently expressed his admiration for Elon Musk, stating that America owes him, quote, huge debt of gratitude, unquote, for his efforts with Doge to find money, to find waste, fraud, and abuse. Now, this story is a little old, but I wanted to get to it because it's been in my queue for a while. He emphasized that Musk's outsider perspective as a business mogul rather than a career politician brings a fresh and pragmatic approach to these fiscal issues. But his stance has drawn criticism. Because people hate Musk. Never mind, there's over 35 billionaires helping Democrats. Our billionaire they don't like. Phil Mickelson's praise of Elon Musk hits the nail on the head. It's ironic that not every American supports DOGE's mission. What's that mission? To eliminate waste, fraud, and abuse. Democrats in particular seem to be resisting it, prioritizing control over national well-being. The left, mainstream media, and progressives, they can't stomach anyone applauding Musk or the Trump administration, so they resort to relentless attacks. And there you have it, my friends, the final whistle. Before I go, do not forget to like and share this podcast. And I hope you enjoy the show. March Madness, I tried to explain why they're saying UNC got in versus a reality. Some NFL news, a realistic take on some of this information. But, I got to admit, it's become more and more fair, these takes, because of the internet. But I hope you enjoyed mine. And I hope you enjoyed my ugly truth segment of racism. And until we look in the mirror, we've got to do that. I want to come together. We are all Americans first. The fact that we've been divided into being Puerto Rico first, Mexicano first, Black first, Japanese first, that's who and what we are, but we are Americans first. We can be prideful of our culture, our background, who we are, but we are Americans first, and that's what will secure the future for our children and our children's children. And if we keep going at it in a tribalistic way, nothing good will come about it. And I hope you enjoyed the final whistle as well. Do not forget to bookmark grumblingsmedia.com. You can find us on YouTube, Rumble, Apple, Spotify, y Pandora under the handle Grumblings Media. I hope you have enjoyed the show, and I am William Del Pilar for Points on the Board. And until next week, I bid you adieu.